Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and today I'm joined by film and content specialist Cam Maitland and curator and film historian Alicia Fletcher. If your knowledge of burlesque on film is limited to the Cher Christina Aguilera vehicle, you maybe, just maybe, are missing out on a genre of film that is very much for you. If you're a fan of the movie musical, as I am, extravagant costumes, as I am, and tongue-in-cheek performances, as, well, you get it. One of those elements will almost always be present in the burlesque movie. Today, we're going to look at two unconventional entries into the genre. But before we do that, Alicia, what are some of the best examples and what should we be looking for? I know you're a big fan of these.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's a bit of a disclaimer in that burlesque as a film genre only exists in my brain. Like, there's no book or like no one's ever done a burlesque like retrospective. It's something that is very personal to me. So I feel kind of guilty that I forced us to do this episode. For me, as someone who programs a film series called Ladies of Burlesque, there are multiple components. You can, of course, have a classic film that takes place in a burlesque house, which there are many. But for me, it's more important to think of burlesque in terms of its definition from the 19th century, which is satirizing, making fun of respectable art forms, specifically with subversive characters, most usually women, talking back at the audience. So basically taking the piss out of opera, taking the piss out of high art theater. And I think for me, these two films do that. So as much as I love, you know, a film like Lady of Burlesque with Barbara Stanwyck, which is written by Gypsy Rose Lee, or, you know, something like...
Or even just straight Gypsy. Like, we can talk
Gypsy
about that too.
Gypsy is certainly a burlesque film. Gentlemen Prefer Blondes to me is a burlesque film, despite it doesn't, you know, take place in a burlesque house. Where I love trying to wrap my head around burlesque on film is more films like Popeye by Robert Altman, which is, if you haven't seen Popeye from 1980, for me, it's canonical burlesque in that it's Robin Williams and Shelley Duvall acting out a comic strip character with prosthetic body parts, and the whole world that they're creating is neither a live action world nor animation, nor it's just burlesque to me. As is something, and I know this is a film that comes up a lot, but Bugsy Malone,
sure.
You know, this idea of a gangster film using very 1930s and 1940s classic film tropes acted out entirely by children, including Jodie Foster and Scott Baio, where, you know, they're in Flintstones-esque gangster cars, and instead of bullets, they're assassinating rival gangs with cream pies. That's burlesque to me. So that's why I think both this first film we're going to talk about, which is animated, and then later a very interesting ballet on film, which we have very few of post-1950, to me is burlesque, if that makes any sense at all.
Yeah, I pick up what you're putting down. And there's something too, because like, there's such a fine line between the idea of the movie musical and burlesque. And when I think about the word burlesque, I think there's a risque aspect to it as well. There's something that's going to challenge the audience, be it sexually, be it intellectually, be it like, am I going to sit there and watch Robin Williams do weird facial expressions for an hour and a half and be delighted to the songs of Harry Nilsson?
Like,
yes, I am.
To use the musical as an example, to me, Singing in the Rain is not burlesque. It is,
no.
You know, it is a musical. However, looking at someone like Jacques Demy, and let me bring it up again, almost every episode, or more so, you know, Young Girls of Roquefort, even Umbrellas of Cherbourg, those are burlesque because Demy is looking at the classic musicals like Singing in the Rain from the decade prior or two decades prior and satirizing them in some ways. So that's where the burlesque comes in to me. So not every musical is a burlesque, but there are quite a few musicals that are sort of revisionist musicals or neo-musicals that end up being burlesque. Mm.
And some of them do just sit straight in the like fans and feathers, you know, pasty sure. genre Showgirls. As we think of.
Chlorines.
Exactly. Yeah, yes. Exactly. Yeah. It was, yeah. So that's totally still a thing. And in the fans and feathers genre is where you're going to find our first movie today, Shin Bone Alley, an animated movie based on a Broadway musical, based on a concept album, based on a series of cartoons and stories from the 1910s and 20s. And although watching it today, the movie seems a bit sketchy, literally, this was really a groundbreaking film at the time. Animation was still considered for kids, even though Tex Avery had long been on the scene, like in the 30s and 40s with shorts like Red Hot Riding Hood. Go check that one out if you want something a little spicy for the children. And of course, the very existence of Betty Boop. But it really took until the 70s before animators started explicitly adding adult themes, including burlesque and overt sexuality, into full-length animated movies. Now, keep in mind that Ralph Bakshi's Fritz the Cat, the first X-rated animated film, would follow it the next year. Let's have a look at Shin Bone Alley. Cam. Are you a fan of this one? Had you heard of this one before the podcast?
No, I hadn't. I'd only heard it from Alicia, who likes it. No, it's a very strange movie. And it's actually a strange play, a strange concept album. It's all based on this ancient strip, like a column that was satire, comedy, poetry.
Yeah, it's not even a comic strip. It's like an animated opinions column from the New York Evening Standard or something like that.
Like a joke, but also seemingly kind of sometimes real poetry from the point of view of a cockroach who is a reincarnated poet who is tapping it out on a New York typewriter. Lots of like satire about New York and so it's Archie, the cockroach, and Mehita Bell's the cat. It's like an alley cat, a saucy, sexy alley cat. And they're friends, but he's in love with her, but she kind of loves him as a friend. And
it weird. Opens with a suicide. This writer is going to kill himself. You see it on screen.
Yes.
And instead of dying, is transmigrated into the body of a cockroach.
Which is delightful. And I think one about like this seems like I haven't read the articles yet. I'm going to go look them up. Apparently there's like a collected works available to purchase. And the sense of humor seems very me. Like, for example, everything is written in lowercase letters. So both Archie and Mehita Bell are written in lowercase letters. And apparently there's one installment, which is capitals at last, because he learns how to hit the shift key at the same time because he's a cockroach, right? So you can only jump from thing to thing. I'm like, that is very funny. I actually really like that.
Yeah, I think this, from what I understand of this, let's say it's not a comic strip, but for just clarification or for simplification, let's do that. It really was, you know, it originates in 1916 and goes into the 20s. It really was this sort of very popular, almost like The Daily Show would be to us today, or the John Oliver Show, where it was commenting on news events and social mores as they were changing, especially as gender roles were changing with the flapper coming in and the idea of the teenager being like new, like that kids had disposable income and all of a sudden sexuality changes and courtship changes and politics were changing. And so it was really well widely read. And it's kind of interesting that I only knew it from this film. Mel Brooks adapted it at one point from the like comedy album that was released, and it's had a lot of iterations, and yet all of them, including this film, I would argue, are completely lost.
Yeah, it's like, it's interesting because this is kind of, when you go through it, it's kind of a like, this is an adaptation of this stuff from the turn of the century, kind of adapted into the 50s and 60s, and then the animated film is made of that in the 1970s. So it's this kind of multiple iterations. And I think in some ways it's it works, and in some ways you're like, oh yeah, especially knowing, like you said, Fritz the Cat is next year, and this is kind of adult in its own way, but it kind of is between kid and adult and can't quite decide. And the humor, like, it's weird that it doesn't make fun of hippies, for instance.
No, it doesn't at all.
It makes fun of beatniks, really. Like, it seems to be jokes about beatniks.
Yeah, that's what's drawing for the 60s, right? Like, that's the, I think, the biggest thing. I think is interesting, it's a lot of reviewers at the time because, like we have said, there's really nothing for adults in animation at this time. It's not really considered that way. Sure. A lot of the adults are like, this is going to go over the heads of 8-year-olds. And it's like, yeah, it opens with a suicide. Who do you think this is for? It's very interesting.
It's not far from Fritz the Cat is the interesting thing. Right. Like, I feel like the humor and stuff is adult. Like, it's not, I don't think it's trying to be a kid's animation at all.
No.
Like, I think it's trying to be an adult animation. So I think it's more almost that they didn't know how to market it yet. Yeah. They didn't know, and there wasn't the midnight showings and stuff. And I mean, also, when this is at its best, I think, it's when it's the weird experimental animation, like, honestly, you should be on drugs, trip out stuff.
Yeah, and it is, speaking of that experimental aspect to this film, there's a lot of hearkening back to the animations of the teens and the 20s, which were absolutely for adults. So the original, like, illustrator of these two characters for the comic strip or the column was George Harriman, who is maybe a name that not a lot of people would recognize unless you're really into animation, but he developed Crazy Cat and Ignatz Mouse and was like a forerunner to Mickey Mouse, really important as a pioneer of animation. And they have cameos from those two characters in this film and some of those acid trip scenes. So there's definitely an aspect of this film being in conversation with the history of animation. It's just in a 2021 lens, we've forgotten that whole history, so it just doesn't make sense. Damn. But I liked kind of reading about that. And yeah, the colors are super bright. It's a very anti-Disney palette. If you look at like the Disney color palette of the 70s, and in season one, we talked about Watership Down from 1978. So I'd refer listeners, if they have this interest in animation, to definitely listen to that one. This idea of like anti-Disney palette, anti-Disney brushstrokes, really using so many different styles of animation. And I'm not sure it entirely works. I don't think they all work together in harmony.
No.
But they're, like you say, Cam, those ones with the kind of Schoolhouse Rock aesthetic look great.
Yeah, absolutely Schoolhouse Rock, yeah.
It seems very similar to heavy metal. If people have seen heavy metal, this is better. But like in that, the fact that like the animation keeps changing in that way.
Yeah, it is weird that like a number, it almost seems like it should change a little more. And also, it's kind of, unfortunately, a letdown when it goes back to the sort of, you know, somewhat Hanna-Barbera-y, I guess, but more nicer, like, animals, which are fine. But, yeah, you're right. It's like Schoolhouse Rock. It's like the old, like, Tootsie Pop commercials, that kind of animation that was very big in the 70s. Again, kind of weird to me that a lot of it looks a lot like 70s animation in the way that was very popular, but it just didn't connect, I guess.
There was a lot of kiddie films in the 60s and 70s that predate Aristocats. So Aristocats is 1970, so obviously that's a pretty popular Disney film and one of the first Disney films to have cats that weren't maniacally evil, I would say. But in the 60s, especially through Warner Brothers and some of the Looney Tunes stuff, but you had a film like Gay Paree. Like, there was a lot of animated kiddie films. Gay Paree actually was voiced by Judy Garland. It's an amazing film. I love it so much. But it gets all swallowed up in the, like, Disney hegemony that we live with. And I think it's fascinating to me that this is a film about cats because they're not super popular. And she does try to drown her kittens and sings a song about it.
And apparently in the original version, she actually does drown the kittens. She succeeds in killing the
kittens.
Life
is hard in the alleys, you know? Like,
yes.
I'd be okay. I don't know. That's the one part I was like, nope, no longer on her side. Yeah. Sorry, don't try to kill a cat.
True. She is a terrible mother. It is also worth saying that this was the, like, weird time for both Disney and kids movies where I think, like, there, while this is a weird tonally movie, there also wasn't, like, I mean, we've talked about teenagers, they marketed Abominable Dr. Fives
too. Good point.
They didn't know about tweens, so essentially you have, like, this year you have, like, Bedknobs and Broomsticks or, like, The Million Dollar Duck or, like, a Kurt Russell movie. And or you have this. So
did
it's
you
like
just make up
of
the Million Dollar Duck?
No,
because that's
Cam and I talk about Million Dollar Duck all the time. When Disney Plus was launching, our joke was like, yeah, but are they going to have Million Dollar Duck? And they did.
And I think that they do. I think you can log on to Disney Plus and watch the Million Dollar Duck. It's all these like Dean Jones movies.
Okay.
Just these kind of duds nowadays that no one thinks about, like the Apple Dumpling Gang and stuff, were what they were making.
The Cat from Outer Space.
So, Yeah, like your favorite. But anyway, so it's like kind of a weird time because there's not quite kids movies yet. Or you think about something like that we talk about on the TV show, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory,
which
was a huge and a huge failure at the box office too. Like, it just, nothing was really, I don't think that they quite knew what to do with kids.
Well, and it's interesting, and to your point, Cam, like, if you were making this for kids, then Carol Channing was not who you should have cast. And to me, Carol Channing is delightful in this. I love Carol Channing. I love that Carol Channing is getting, I mean, she only passed relatively recently. She's quite elderly. Mm-hmm. But in the queer community, even through like RuPaul's Drag Race, Carol Channing is queen. And I love that there's like probably very radicalized tweens looking up who Carol Channing is, and like possibly this film would come up. But certainly in 1971, Carol Channing was a huge celebrity. And she would have been really well known for all of her Broadway work. Specifically, she starred in the role that we think of for Marilyn Monroe in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes in 1949, so predating the film version of 1953. And she starred as Lorelei Lee and even did a Broadway sequel to it called Lorelei. So she was very associated with this burlesque sort of flapper, gold digger, which Mehetabel the mouse definitely is. She's just not very good at it.
Mehetabel the cat.
Sorry, Mehetabel the cat is a gold digger. She's just really bad at it. Mm. So it's funny to think about Carol Channing as an animated character in a misguided children's film 50 years after the fact.
But she is an animated character.
Yes,
you think of every character she plays, and she's got one of my favorite performances she does is with Perry Como, her singing If You Hadn't But You Didn't. If people haven't heard her do that, go watch her do it. It is one of the funniest things. But even like Raspberries, that she's like leaning out of a plane, is like pure burlesque cartoon animated.
It's vaudeville too, you know? Like burlesque and vaudeville. Mm-hmm. I think you probably not for the next film, but you could have, instead of burlesque, you could have inserted the word vaudeville into this description of the film. And they go hand in hand. I mean, burlesque was shown in vaudeville reviews and vaudeville tropes were used in burlesque, etc. But she is so fascinating. And she has a really great episode of The Muppet Show. If anyone is watching The Muppet Show on Disney Plus, like, her hosting The Muppet Show is pretty epic. And I think that that is the perfect environment for her. And I think this is a really good environment for her in Shinbone Alley.
She doesn't star in a lot of movies
either,
which is kind of interesting. She's actually, she doesn't have a lot of, I mean, she was mostly a stage actor, so she doesn't have a ton of credits.
And she's top billed.
And not a ton of good ones either.
This was one of her favorite roles as well. There's a fantastic interview she did contemporaneously with Studs Terkel. Please, no one ruin Studs Terkel for me. I really like him.
He's great.
I don't know who Studs
Terkel. He did Working. Are you familiar with Working? He did a book where he interviewed all. He's essentially like one of the first. He's like the original NPR.
I can picture his name written in. Okay, got it.
Yes.
Yeah. He has a voice that's very similar to Hunter S. Thompson. If Hunter S. Thompson did not become a heavy addict. Like, he's got that very dry. I'm a big Studs Terkel fan, so I'm really hoping no one does. But he's just so charming, and like how dryly he tosses stuff off. And one of the questions he asks her as she's talking about how much she loves doing it, this, is he says, there's nothing wrong with saying toujours gay, is there? Or even being toujours gay. I'm like, no, Studs, there is not. And I think this is such a perfect role for her because she seemed like someone who was always, even though not a gold digger, not everything Mehetabel is, she was always looking for the bright side of things and was always like, at 97, you know, she's doing RuPaul's Drag Race cameos and is delighted by Bob the Drag Queen's impersonation of her. And like, she just seemed like she had that joie de vivre. And the character of Mehetabel could have been so dour and unlikable and horrible, except for, don't we all want that pursuit of happiness that she has? And that isn't that why Archie loves her?
It's interesting how her character changes from the original, because the way that she's drawn by George Harriman is that, you know, she's this emaciated cat with a, I'm just quoting, this isn't a word that I would choose, a gimpy hind leg with patchy fur that's perpetually frozen. And that's why she warms up by dancing so she doesn't freeze to death. Very different embodiment of Mehetabel in this film, where she's sultry and slinky and kind of flappery and very curvaceous for a cat.
Well, even her little, like, we talk about the fans in fur, literally. Mm-hmm. Even like her little tail is like a fan, right? That's how she uses it in her hips and everything.
It's very Pepe Le Pew. I mean, that's a good reference too, because the animator of this would go on and do sort of the Bugs Bunny and Tweety Hour. So that's like the Looney Tunes incarnation that people of our generation who were kids in the 80s and 90s would have grown up with. It's not the original Looney Tunes, is what was kind of playing on Saturday morning TV. And that trajectory makes sense for me watching this film, that someone would go to the Looney Tunes side. Mm-hmm. And I love that as part of a kind of back and forth, that this film is very Looney, very Tex Avery and very Looney Tunes. And then it ends up influencing a later incarnation of Looney Tunes.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about Carol Channing playing Mehetabel. The role was originated by Eartha Kitt.
Yes.
And I do have to say that I don't know which... Oh, sorry, Tammy Grimes was in there as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think it goes back and forth, actually, because I think Carol Channing literally originated it, but Eartha Kitt was on Broadway.
Yeah,
right. And then it became Tammy Grimes, and then it went back to...
Carol Channing was the album. Yes, correct.
Yeah, gotcha. Yeah. They're all unusual women's voices, which I kind of love the idea that they're... Yeah, if people aren't familiar with Tammy Grimes, there's another, like, incredible Broadway actress with, like, a very unusual voice.
And this is Eartha Kitt in 1957, so it's pre-Catwoman Eartha Kitt. So then there's another way that this film is influencing, you know, this gargantuan pop culture milestone that is Adam West's Batman. So it's interesting to see all of this DNA in Shinbone Alley and then go to research it. And, like, I read a few period-specific reviews from 1971, and then it is just radio silence about this film. And I don't remember how I found this. I was probably doing a weird kitty thing because I try to, I have a cat. I think I'm really interested in films that have non-evil cats. And this might have come up when I was making a list, a listicle or a letterboxed list. And was just like, what is, and it's an interesting name, right? Shinbone Alley. That's such a bizarre title for a film.
Oh, and I mean, if you look it up, like the reason it doesn't exist is because it's like, it was produced by like companies that barely exist. Fine Arts Films. And then it was owned by, or it was distributed by Allied Artists, which also like went out of business in the 70s. And Fine Arts Films is like, it barely, it's mostly the director, John Wilson, who you were talking about, David Dettige.
Yeah, who went on to the animator. Bugs Bunny,
Yeah, but John Wilson, who is the other, the like overseeing director, he's a guy who is like nominated for an Oscar for this like Japanese style animated film called Terra the Stonecutter. And then he essentially did kind of like classy British stuff, or he did a couple ads
John Wilson
and things.
Who did Grease? Yes. Because he animated the title sequence for Grease.
He did the title sequence for Grease. Cool. That's probably like his biggest thing. And he also did all the animated sequences of the Sonny and Cher show.
That's so cool.
Which was pretty big at the time. Yeah. And the Carol Burnett ending is him, apparently. So he kind of just did random stuff, lots of filler things, like the I think that's the trailer for Irma LaDuce is animated by him.
Oh yeah, I didn't know. I mean, I knew it was an animated trailer. I love Irma LaDuce, the Billy Wilder film, but that's it's cool to see. I mean, John Wilson is such a common name that it doesn't stand out.
Yes,
but to see like
they call him John David Wilson often, I think, to make him stand out from the other John Wilson.
I think while watching this, I had assumed that potentially this film had been produced by a cracker company. Because there's a lot of moments where Mehetabel, just in her Carol Channing voice, which I don't do the impression well, is just like, can't I have a cracker? And she just keeps asking for crackers. And it just, I don't know, it made me crave crackers while watching this.
It's a, I mean, it's a very strange, and like, I mean, also all the voices, it's got the voice of Fred Flintstone, Alan Reed. It's got John Carradine playing John Carradine, basically.
Can we talk about that? I think that is the best musical number. Like, we've talked before about how kids' movies is so good. And kids' movies, and I think animation and musicals in general live or die on how catchy the music is. And this one has some clunkers.
Oh,
but,
absolutely.
But that that Romeo and Juliet interpretation is excellent and very, and especially because it's performed by Carol Channing, and like that sort of quick playing with rhythm is a thing that she does, and she does so well that I can't. And John Carradine's a freaking Shakespearean actor, so he's able to pick it up. So the two of them are able to just bounce off each other.
Yeah,
perfectly.
He's this like fraud talent agent theater impresario, but he's just gonna like put her to work on the streets to steal him crackers or something. Like, ridiculous.
Yeah.
I don't.
Yeah, it's very. I mean, it's very fascinating too, because it's like, this is not. It's, I mean, John Carradine's kind of wild because he never stopped acting.
True.
He was like a very high functioning alcoholic, but this is not exactly the height of his career. So it's kind of a strange time to roll him in. The same year he made, let's see, 10 other movies, including Hell's Bloody Devils, Horror of the Blood Monster, Blood of the Iron Maiden. Yeah, I mean, he had a lot of alimony. But The Mummy and The Curse of the Jackals. Like, and this is the ones where he like rolled up behind a desk and did three lines and then they sold it on him. So it's kind of fascinating that he really, with his whole chest, does this movie and does a delightful character that is seemingly animated to look like him too.
Yes.
Which is kind of charming. And is, I think, the majority of the, like, it's most of the plot. We should say this is not a very traditional three-act structure. The Archie bits are mostly just like one-off segments. And then this is like the majority of Mehitabel. Plot is this this John Carradine plot. Mm-hmm.
And it's really Mehitabel's movie. It's not about Archie much at all, which I kind of like because I think a lesser movie, I will say, a movie that's not quite as interesting or something that we wouldn't necessarily be talking about now would just be talking about him trying to romance her and it would all be focused on his obsession with her. But that's not what it is. It's watching her kind of try to survive and then he's narrating her story.
Yeah.
So and he's like the Watson to her Sherlock.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting choice is that it's essentially like, it's kind of about his fraught wanting to be in love with her, but in the end he kind of just realizes why he should still be friends with her even though they'll never be in love, which is an interesting thing.
It's anti-toxic
strange
masculinity
for a children's movie. Yes. And I mean also, I don't know, it's very weird because you're never going to be a cockroach in love with a cat. But that's also a large part
they
of it.
They do kind of address the mechanics of that and how it wouldn't work, so which also makes this
well,
an
he's
adult,
a reincarnated poet, failed writer, so God, and he tries to commit suicide twice, I think. I don't even think, like, it starts with the suicide, and then there's a second time.
He tries multiple, there's, like, the comedy sequence of him trying to commit suicide, and it never works. And, I mean, he also tries to do some sort of, like, pseudo-communist bug uprising.
Yeah.
But, that you definitely see the Mel Brooks, like, because it's Mel Brooks and Morris who would go on to be, like, huge collaborators in a bunch of other films, right?
Yeah.
So, I think
pretty early for him, too. It's like our Show of Shows era Mel Brooks, too. So that's like young man Mel Brooks, which is interesting.
I think this is an important film. If you're interested in Mel Brooks, if you're interested in animation history, if you like cats, if you're a cat person and you're tired of the propaganda that all cats are evil, I think this is a really fascinating film that if it had been released a few years later, more in the era of things like Watership Down and Lord of the Rings, and it would have been, there would have been more, I think, cohesion in its story, but also bolder style. And then it's really impressive because it's 71, because it's just so early in terms of that adult animation canon, but it just doesn't quite stand out enough. However, I think people should watch it. I mean, it's really
the
interesting.
The closest thing I can say, you can see the seeds of the producers here in terms of what the music is doing, in terms of the satire, in terms of the sense of humor. I cannot hear someone say the word springtime without thinking of Springtime for Hitler, which is not a good thing to sing out loud. Wow. Mm-hmm. So I think that, like, yeah, you really see what they are going to go on to create from this musical. It's one of those, like, not necessarily Rosetta Stone, but like it's like an initial seedling kind of
urtext.
You
go back
to do sure, yeah, yeah.
Yes. Oh, there we go. Okay. Yes.
Yeah, and it's like I think you're right that it's. I think also like everyone involved, like John Wilson, when you look at his stuff, he would have probably loved to have made more of a Ralph Bakshi situation, and this movie really probably would have hit better if everyone was stoned and university students.
And if you weren't like watching this on 42nd Street, like Times Square in 1971 with prostitutes, and
totally.
Then go out and get yourself a ladybug. That's all
the ladybug brothel. My God, that was upsetting. That's probably it at its most burlesque in terms of sex workers and. It is. Those were scary ladybugs. I don't know. They've seen some things.
But they are much more compatible with Archie, as I think we all know.
Okay, one of the reasons why this is a strange film is it is produced by a guy who did not produce a lot of movies, but was heavily involved in film with a capital F, Preston M. Fleet, who invented the photomat, which if you remember those yellow things that were in parking lots where you could develop your photos, especially in America. You see them a lot in movies. Quite often characters work in them.
They're now most often old Dutch coffee drive-ups. Like, at least in my state, Oregon, they converted all the photomats to, like, or there's also there's a chain of topless baristas that took over all the food.
Oh, yes. I've seen that in Oregon. What? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, so it's interesting because he invented that, which made him very rich. And he also went on to invent OmniMax, which for Canadians, that's what Science World is.
Yes!
It's an OmniMax theater, the big domes. So, like, it's this kind of weirdo guy who actually did not produce a lot of films. This is one of just a handful of films that he produced. So he also believed in it, too. That's the kind of thing. It is a very kind of unique, not indie, but as damn close to indie as you can get production, which also makes it stand out a lot, like the Bakshi films and stuff like that in the later 70s.
Agreed. Yeah.
I think we're all saying people should go check this one. It's short, too. It's like an hour and like 10 minutes. Yes. Like it's pretty,
I
like
would
it's
even
feature
say
length.
You could watch a 10 minute clip and probably like the best clip and then that suffices it.
I mean, yeah. Well, do you have your favorite part? I think the coolest animation is that moth to the flames.
Yeah, that's really good. I did actually think the ladybugs were trippy. And I don't want to advocate for watching the part where Mehitabel sings about drowning her kittens, but the song affected me because I'm like, yeah, being a single mom on the streets, like I actually think this is a quite realistic take on her not wanting to be a mom and then being knowing what it's going to mean for her career and knowing that her life is basically over because she has these kittens. But she does save them.
It's also worth saying that there's that full sequence that's animated by George Harriman, which is kind of like cool. Yeah. The part with Ignatz and Crazy Cat, which is wild. And probably the only time he had anything in that part of the century.
Absolutely. I think that's true.
Great. So I think we can move on to our next film, and we shall do so gracefully because it is entirely a ballet. Get ready for Uncanny Valley. It's Beatrix Potter coming up after the break.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Our final movie may not be everyone's cup of tea, as it is a ballet created for film. But for those who love incredible physical feat, the stories of Beatrix Potter brought to life, and the reinforcement that rodents, especially squirrels, are total dicks, this will be a real treat. We've talked about ballet shot for film before when we discussed Center Stage last season, but this movie takes it to a whole other level. Even if there are no numbers choreographed to Jamiroquai and no motorcycles, it's still very accessible. For the people, you might say. Alicia, this is ballet, so what exactly makes this one burlesque?
Well, first of all, I want to mention you're talking about Center Stage for people who maybe... What's the Jamiroquai motorcycle? I think this is burlesque mostly because of the costumes and also because there's a lot of ballets where, you know, if you think about Swan Lake, there's creatures a lot in ballet, but this is actually a ballet that is some of the most beautiful costume designs. And this won a BAFTA and was maybe nominated. No, it wasn't nominated for the Oscar, but it was nominated for Christine Edzard, who did the costumes and art direction, was nominated for the BAFTA for this. And there's these masks, these anthropomorphic masks designed by, I'm going to get his name wrong, but Rostislav Dubojinsky, who was like the preeminent Russian mask maker for like Ballet Russe and all kind of like, and it comes off and it's so uncanny and it's so lifelike. It's so lifelike. I don't know. I don't have a great argument for why this is burlesque other than that no other film looks like this. No other film. This is a silent film. There is no dialogue, not a single stitch of dialogue. And we do have human characters where we see Beatrix Potter is a little girl, and I think her nurse and maybe her father. And we're seeing, you know, her actually illustrate these characters, and then the characters kind of jump off the page and they start enacting these stories through ballet. And it's very rare to have a silent film in the early 70s. Like, you don't even have to put subtitles on this film. This could translate to Russian. This translates all over the world. And that's really unusual. But what makes it burlesque to me is just how uncanny, unusual, and satirical it is. Because Beatrix Potter's stories are satirical and strange, especially reading them now in 2021. Like, she was writing the end of the 19th century, and they're very upsetting in some cases with how these creatures are punished. Squirrel Nutkin, the jerk that you were referring to earlier.
Total jerk.
You know, like, he gets his tail eaten off by an owl, and then, like, it's all, it's just... It's,
you want to talk Uncanny Valley? That owl is terrifying in this in this thing. Yeah. But to talk about the costumes and everything, this is one of the most beautiful presentations I think I've ever seen. Everything is to scale. Yes. So when they're in, like, different areas, if they're, like, the tail of two bad mice when they go into their thing. The only thing where it gets a little too weird is that, because everybody's human in the same thing, you got hedgehogs the same size as mice, the same size as squirrels, the same size as ducks, and you're like, hold on a second.
But that,
like,
that's just
a very weird world.
The duck's a little bigger.
Yeah, that goes back to Potter's illustrations, I think, where everything is on one scale. And the mouse you're referring to is named Hunka Munka. So I grew up with Beatrix Potter as one of, even more so than something like the Winnie the Pooh and some of the other kind of stories that most Canadian kids grew up with. I guess I had a very British influence in my childhood, so I knew these characters and these books inside and out. And I had not heard of this film until a year ago. And I full credit to the Criterion Channel for just randomly popping it on a Sunday matinee, and it blew my mind, because I am a big ballet fan, and I love, and we'll talk about Powell and Pressburger in a moment because that connects to this film hugely. But, you know, my assumption of watching a filmed ballet from the 70s would be static camera, pretty bad lighting, like, pretty boring, and that's not this is stunning cinematography. This is movement. This really was made for film. I think it's probably, at least to my eyes, and I'm no expert, the best ballet on film I've seen. It really harkens back to something like The Red Shoes and Tales of Hoffman, as directed by Powell and Pressburger. And that makes sense because the director of this film, and it's his only film, Reginald Mills, is the Academy Award nominated editor for The Red Shoes and a lot of Powell and Pressburger films, especially the ballet sequences. And it's choreographed by Sir Frederick Ashton, who was a student of Leonid Mazin, who choreographed all the Powell and Pressburger films, including Red Shoes. So there's a real Powell and Pressburg heritage to this film that I think helps with how surreal. It's uncanny and it's very surreal.
Mm-hmm. Also, very important to say, Mr. Frederick Ashton plays Mrs. Tiggy Winkle.
Yeah, who opens the film. Miss Tiggy Winkle is a hedgehog laundress. Yeah. She was one of my favorites growing up. I had a watercolor.
She's in a lot of the stories, right?
She
That's
is,
like one
yeah.
of the few I could name off the top of my head was Mrs.
Yeah,
Tiggy
my
Winkle.
Great aunt was a somewhat notable artist in British Columbia. And when I was little, every year she would paint me a Beatrix Potter watercolor. So I have like a stack of all of these characters painted in like the 1980s from this woman who's long passed. But that's why I kind of, names like Jemima Puddle Duck, Hunka Munka,
yes.
Pigling Bland,
I love
Mr. Todd,
so
Jeremy
good.
Fisher. I also have a bunch of brooches. I wear a lot of, like, even if you watch a year in film, I'm willing to bet, go to a random episode, I'm probably wearing a Beatrix Potter brooch.
We're also in a weird time because, like, obviously between this film and, like, 5 years ago, no child would have cared so much about Beatrix Potter. But now the movies are kind of huge again. Those Peter Rabbit movies do pretty well. And they have all these guys in it, even if they're just background characters. I think all the dudes show up. I've only seen the first one, but I seem to remember.
What do you think Beatrix Potter and or Sir Frederick Ashton would have taken from James Corden as Peter Rabbit?
I mean, he does like to get down and boogie sometimes.
Yeah, I guess that's a Peter thing.
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing is there's not a lot of Peter Rabbit.
I was just going to say.
No.
Like, this is a very light on Peter Rabbit, which is kind of a wild choice.
No, I don't think so. I think the reason why is because he's fighting against Mr. McGregor, who's really the only human in a lot of them. And therefore, if you're working with the scale aspect,
that's
you
fair.
Can't do
that's
it.
That's a great point.
He's like our audience surrogate. He's always peeking around something, checking
out
what's
Benjamin
going on.
Bunny is a big character too, and I definitely wear him on one episode. I can't remember which year, but I color coordinated a cardigan to my Benjamin Bunny brooch. And yeah, he's not in it, so it is.
I mean, neither Flopsy, Mopsy, nor Cotton Taylor are available in this film.
It's interesting when you think about. I'm doing a lot of thinking about Beatrix Potter. I know we have a biopic starring Renee Zellweger, which I have not seen from 2006, but believe is universally panned and thought to be terrible. She was, you know, Beatrix Potter was one of the first children's authors to understand the gold mine in merchandising toys from books to children, but not just toys, but homeware, like housewares. Like, if you think about it, I remember growing up with, I want to say it was maybe Royal Dalton or something, but all the Beatrix Potter dishes for babies that exist, and you see them now at Value Villages all the time. But she was really the first author in the 19th century to realize, she was like the proto George Lucas, where she was making something, media in this case, literature, and then marketing toys for it.
Mm-hmm. She was also stripping the flesh off of animals with with various types of acid to be able to get the illustrations correct. So, you know, she was very much of the, like, and I mean, that's, her illustrations are gorgeous, and that's part of the reason why she was doing anatomical studies that other people weren't
doing. And she's a huge name in terms of conservation. Like, she really is considered someone who conserved a lot of the Lake District in England. She was very wealthy, and she bought a lot of land and then left it to the National Trust. And yeah, and then, you know, she was heinous towards animals in a way that someone from the 1870s living on a farm who ate rabbit every day probably would be.
But they're shooting a lot of this in the actual Lake District. Like, they are actually outdoors in a lot of
which is beautiful.
Yeah, it's absolutely gorgeous. I mean, this is a beautiful movie. Going into this, I have to admit, I was kind of like, oh my God, do I want to sit through this? It doesn't overstay its welcome. It's very charming. I was delighted by this. And at no point was I like, okay, I need to go to the bathroom. I was like, no, this is really lovely.
Well, it's interesting because you had the same opinion as Roger Ebert, because Roger Ebert was assigned this in 1971. It was showing in two movie theaters in New York City. Or maybe one in Chicago, one in New York City, and he was assigned this to review and was like, ginormous eye roll. He doesn't like ballet. He says, the first thing he says in the review is that he's never seen a live ballet, which I thought was interesting.
Oh, wow.
And he was prepared to fully hate this and was absolutely won over by how nuanced it is and how the characters don't dance like Nureyev, they dance like a frog. Like, Jeremy Fisher is doing, it's just the translation of the choreography, and this is, of course, the Royal Ballet from London, who performed in Covent Garden. It is just such a mastery of choreography, and he kind of apologizes at the end of his review and humbles himself, which I really appreciated reading, and then brings up the fact, and this is really interesting, that this theater is only showing in rich neighborhoods. Or sorry, this movie is only showing in rich neighborhoods with movie theaters. And so it's really, although in England, this was a box office smash.
Yeah, which is also fascinating. And I think also maybe points to, not to fully show my cards, maybe points to how few movies there are for kids. I do remember going to the ballet and enjoying it as a kid, but it is a little wild to me that this was like a hit.
Yeah, I think it is wild, but I think it is a testament to its production values.
Aside from not just being for kids, though, there was nothing like this tonally on either side, right? Because one of my favorite things is there's an interview with one of the producers in the Los Angeles Times before this was released, saying this was more daring to produce than a porno, because at this point everything was dark, everything was nasty, it was vicious. We talked about how cynical most of the 70s are, and especially the early 70s coming out of like the Summer of Love and the end of that, right? This is just pure ephemera, joy, delight. It's escapism. The tagline for this is literally, do you remember when you were small?
That's
which is
so
what
sweet.
It's doing. It's bringing you back into that. And it's guileless. And I can see how there's some people who would look at this and go, oh, it's too twee.
Yeah.
But I don't think it is. I think it sits like in this very weird sweet spot of just being gentle, kind, but still approachable and not saccharine.
I do think that it's a better tagline than the one that you just read, to say that it was harder to pull off than porno. Like, that should have been on the poster, and that's probably where it could have gotten better distribution in the U.S.
Harder to pull off.
It's a great point. I mean, yeah, I've watched this a few times since seeing it for the first time on Criterion. It is theoretically an MGM film, I believe, at least in North America. So it's possible for people to see this. It's the magic of cinema, right? There's certain kind of meta films that in their exact form just sort of celebrate what cinema can do like no other. And if you think about ballet, ballet can be conveyed in paintings and drawings in some ways. Like, Degas does a very good job of trying to convey movement in painting and drawing in his case, but you can't really pull it off. You certainly can't, you know, it really has to be seen live. And before the invention of the moving image, there was no way to replicate seeing a ballet for the masses unless they were there in person. So, and that's why at the beginning of cinema history, if you think about like 1895, 1896, someone like Louis Fuller, they're looking at, which is both also very burlesque, they're looking at dancers and ballet for the very earliest films. You know, filmmakers like Edison and other companies are looking to ballet because it celebrates something that could not have ever been done without this invention. And so seeing something almost 100 years later that's doing just that and doing it so well, where you can actually take, you know, for Sir Frederick Ashton, this very famous dancer and choreographer, and put him in a hedgehog suit and little black booties in a apron, and just, I'd never at any point really focused on those characters being dancers. I focused on them being
or male
animals.
Or female. They're just the characters.
Interchangeable. Like, yeah, it really was like, and I think because I know these names and they're characters I grew up with, I'm like really excited to see the fox pull the feathers out of Jemima Puddle Duck's butt. And that's as violent as it is, a very violent act. And she's just like wiggling her butt and trying to run away. And you know the danger because, you know, fox are going to eat geese. That's going to happen.
And the danger is real. Like, when Squirrel Nutkin's getting messed up by the owl, you're like, oh, okay, I know where the story goes, but if I was a kid, like, I don't know what I would do there.
Nutkin had it coming.
Nutkin did have it coming. I want to talk about Frederick Ashton just for a second, because apparently he was known for his party impersonations. Specifically, he would do Queen Victoria on a regular basis, but he often played female characters. Like, he played the Wicked Stepsister in Cinderella and a bunch of stuff. And he has a great little mini documentary that they made for him, which is also very charming. He seems like a really interesting dude. And so to get to see any of that work preserved, I think is also really a testament to the medium and a testament to the film. And I want to talk about just for a second some of the physical feats, because they're, like you said, these costumes, like, just go look at the costumes at the be all and end all, and know that people are dancing in these like gargantuan things where like you can't see their eyes, like the eyes are the character's eyes. For me, is Jemima Puddle Duck with that giant back end on fucking point. I'm like, how are you doing that when you're obviously off balance? That's incredibly impressive.
Yeah, there's a lot of technical feats, and keep in mind they're under, you know, I think stage lighting is very hot when you're dancing ballet live, but I think probably on a soundstage it's really, really hot. It is really impressive, and it really, the only thing I can really compare it to is something like Tales of Hoffman, directed by Michael Power and Emmerich Pressburger, and then also The Red Shoes, which I think The Red Shoes has come up on this podcast. Certainly when we talked about Center Stage, we talked about The Red Shoes, and that is one of my favorite films of all time. And the fact that this is Reginald Mills, who edited both of those films, his only directorial film, is really interesting to me. He doesn't go on to do much. He does a lot of editing later. He edits, he had edited a lot of interesting British film noir, like The Servant. Like, he's such a fascinating figure and a name I'd never heard of. Like, certainly reading about Powell and Pressburger, I'm sure Reginald Mills' name had come up because he, of course, was nominated for the Academy Award. But I never thought about him, and now I'm thinking about him, and that is really nice, because like, going through his filmography, I'm like, wow, we don't pay enough tribute to editors. And when they do get a chance to make a film, he chose this, which is crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this whole movie, I am kind of fascinated by like what comes out of it, too, because like if you talk about beyond that, the like main writers and producers are Richard Goodwin and Christine Edzard, who's mm-hmm. like who are a married couple, yeah. and they go on to create this company, Sands Films, which is interesting because it's both a production company and a costume house.
Right.
And sometimes it is costuming films, sometimes it's not, but they essentially become the premier home of period pieces. And sometimes he essentially does all those Agatha Christie ones in the 70s.
Oh.
He produces okay. them and is like, he's like a co-producer on them. But then they go on the, probably the one, if you ever watched Little Dorrit in school, they make the Little yeah. Dorrit, which is by her. She adapts, she even has some original films, but she adapts a lot of major works. But yeah, they do all these pretty famous period pieces, including like Passage to India. They did all the costumes
the
for
craftsmanship.
And, yeah, her big thing was Zeffirelli's Romeo and Juliet.
Yes,
that's hers.
Yeah,
yes.
yeah.
Which
well,
is,
she also
you know, wow.
she trained under Zeffirelli's art director for the theater. So yeah. she was working with Zeffirelli in Italy. So that's like kind of fascinating. So yeah, and it's interesting because Sands Film still exists, and it's this like small company that will bust out when there's like a sometimes they produce things, but sometimes they're just making the costumes like constantly.
It really is the craftsmanship in this mm-hmm. film is unbelievable. I was kind of reading Richard Goodwin discuss why he wanted to make this, and like a lot of I think interviews at the time, especially in the UK, were like really questioning like why, like how this so it's so uncanny that this would be so successful. And he said he really wanted to make a visual souffle, and I was like, God, that's Ooh. A good term. Like this
that's
film
exactly what he made
is a souffle. And I think Shin Bone Alley in terms of animation is a bit of a souffle. And now anytime you read any of my film reviews, of which I write very few, you can expect the word souffle will be used.
Oh boy!
Yeah. It's but it is.
Like, stop
it
calling
is.
Every movie a souffle.
Every movie is
a burlesque souffle.
That is only the movies that she is going to be watching from here on in and reviewing. She's going to wait for the right one and then pounce. It's going to happen.
You know what else is a souffle? Phantom Thread.
Sure.
Yeah. If I were to do a thing on souffle on film, she makes a lot of souffles. But I've definitely cut that out of that.
I mean, it's a bit of an omelet.
Yeah.
Lord. Okay. I am ending this episode.
All right, fine.
So once again, Alicia Fletcher, thank you so much for joining us and for bringing both of these movies. They were both really charming and delightful.
Yeah.
It was a nice little break from like all of the horror that we have been looking at and also all the horror that we're going into.
Yes. I thank both of you for watching these with me. I hope viewers have a chance or listeners have a chance to view these films. And I just love the name Pigling Bland. I just think that's such a great name for a character. Sure. Pigling Bland.
The next cat you have, you should name Pigling Bland.
Yeah, there's a lot of... There's been cats I've had in my past where I've definitely thought about Beatrix Potter names. Cats are evil in Beatrix Potter. There's Tom Kitten, but it's not a very cat-friendly universe, I would say.
Ah, I see. Okay, and you got to stick with it, I understand. Cameron Maitland, thank you once again.
Thank you. I will say that if you're looking for these movies, they're easy to find.
Yes.
Yes.
maybe Google these and see what comes up.
I think we can promote archive.org. That's an open information source.
I think
so.
Sure.
Yeah.
And they're charming, they're nice, they're quick. It's just pleasant. If you need a break from everything else that's
and
going on,
and if you
on,
run
a
weird
watch.
Boutique DVD label, give these guys some money, because all these producers seem like nice people.
That's right. All right, and next week we're going to be joined by special guest Anna Swanson and looking at two movies about class struggle. It's John Cassavetes' most quote-unquote approachable film, Minnie and Moskowitz, as well as W.R., Mysteries of the Organism, because why wouldn't we want to look at Yugoslavian art house cinema? That's coming up next week. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Want to email the podcast? You can do so at podcast@hollywoodsuite.ca. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, @HollywoodSuite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial-free, Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen on 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite on demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted by Becky Shrimpton and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cameron Maitland, and featured Cameron Maitland and Alicia Fletcher as guests. Supervising producer is Ryan Maines. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria.
Creative consultant is Emily Gagné. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. We'll see you next week.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.